Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. It's horrible. Utah snowpack hits the worst levels on record. Demonizing legislators for legislating. How many bills are too many for Utah lawmakers? And Utah's massive data centers can't get the power they need, so they're building their own. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. And we have with us water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Let's start with Robert Gerke. I want to start with update on the attempt to repeal Prop 4. I guess the deadline to get this the signatures, the amount of signatures they need, is just a couple of days away, I think.
Yeah, they're right up against it now. The deadline to turn in their signature packets is Sunday. By 5. And so the county clerk's offices are going to be open Sunday to accept those packets. As it stands right now, the group Utahns for Representative Government, this is backed by the state Republican Party. They're sitting at about, at last look, about 85,000 signatures that have been validated. They've got to get up to 140,000, almost 141,000. Statewide, and then they've also got to hit specific targets in 26 of 29 Senate districts. So they've got a lot of work to do. But, you know, they talked to organizers this week on the Republican side, and they acknowledge that they're holding that it's going to be close, but they said they've got a bunch of packets in hand that they're going to be dumping on Sunday. Chances are we won't know one way or another on Sunday whether or not they've got the signatures they need. The county clerks are still going to have to go back and validate those signatures, make sure they're valid, and then figure out which Senate districts they fall into to figure out if they've met their target. If they do meet their target, then in November, voters will get to decide on whether to repeal Proposition 4. This is the bill that banned gerrymandering in the state. And it'll be, the question is simply, you know, do you want to get rid of the Independent Redistricting Commission and the ban on partisan gerrymandering? If they fall short, then obviously that's not going to be on the ballot. And then there's a third option or a third possibility that we could have where they meet the threshold, but then the opponents of the repeal effort, we're talking about Better Boundaries and some of their affiliated groups, have 45 days to go try to convince people to rescind their signatures, which could knock them back down under the threshold. And we've seen that happen before, actually. In 2018, Count My Vote had met the signature threshold in the individual Senate districts they needed, but enough people were convinced to rescind their signatures, they fell short in the Senate districts and it wasn't on the ballot. So while Sunday is the deadline for this, there's a very good chance, I would say, that we won't know for sure one way or another for at least a week or two, or possibly even after that 45-day period.
In the meantime, Utah County Clerk has said that he's detected forgeries.
Yeah, well, suspected forgeries, I guess. He's turned some of them over to the county clerk or a county attorney in Utah County. He said he's got 27 packets of petition packets where the upwards of 90-95% of the signatures were invalid. And that's a big red flag for him, obviously. The suspicion is that people were just signing names. He contacted some of the names, the people whose names were on the petition, and they said they either didn't sign it or they had signed it previously and not on that day and not on that time. So that's a big red flag. The Utahns for Representative Government said that when they were alerted to this, they dismissed the signature gatherers who were suspected of having done this and are working with the county attorney to get to the bottom of it. They refer to these people as bad actors that shouldn't, taint the entire process. But it kind of also falls into the larger trend or some of the things we've talked about on here before, where people have said that they've been deceived by the signature gatherers or told, given misinformation to try to convince them to sign it. And as we talked about, I think last week, there's been allegations of on the other side, the petition opponents of, intimidation and even violence in some instances to try to keep this off the ballot. So tempers are pretty high, I would say. It's and it probably have gotten only more amped up as we get closer and closer to this important deadline.
As you say, we won't really know for a while, but you have a map here in your story. Looks like right now they're lagging in Senate districts along the Wasatch Front.
Yeah, that's sort of been the trend throughout. As of yesterday, they got their fourth Senate district, but all four of them are in southern Utah. They're still way behind in Davis, Weber, or Salt Lake County. The organizers have told me that they have a lot of packets that they're going to be turning in on Sunday in those counties. So it's probably too early to say that they're in trouble there. But it's that's the area of the state that where they're facing the biggest challenge, and obviously the area of the state that's most populated. So it's pretty hard for them to pull this off, but the legislature's made the path to the initiative difficult on purpose, and now they're kind of facing the results of that. So we're going to be watching pretty closely to see how those come in those districts. If they fall short, I was doing the math the other day, and I think they need 44,000 in Salt Lake County alone, from where they stood as of yesterday, to meet that goal or meet the Senate district goal that they have to get to. The other thing that's kind of interesting, though, like I said, the numbers that we're looking at, that 85,000 that they've got it valid so far, that's a lagging indicator. So we're looking back to signature packets or signatures that were signed up to a month ago, and are just being validated now. So the numbers are fluid. The tally that we've got right now is a snapshot, and as of a few weeks ago at least. And so there's still a lot of possibilities here.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and Salt Lake Tribune. We're talking with politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, I want to move to this story. Here's the headline: Demonizing Legislators for Legislating. How many bills are too many for Utah lawmakers? That's a question being asked by some, in part because lawmakers reached a record, I think, for at least 3 weeks into the session.
Yeah, as of the end of last week, they had easily surpassed the record for the most bills filed or introduced. And so this is something that we've heard from Republican leadership for a long time, that they're concerned about the number of bills that are being introduced and the number of bills that are being passed. They shot they're 45% more bills this year than through the first 3 weeks of last year. I think that as I've tracked the numbers this week, it's slowed down a little bit, I think. Part of that, according to Senator Lincoln Fillmore, who I talked to, he's the chair of the Senate Rules Committee. He said that, legislators know that they needed to get their requests in early to get them drafted in time. They're obviously drafting bills more quickly than they have in the past, but they're on pace right now to introduce, assuming, trends hold from previous years, upwards of 1,200 bills. And that would easily be a record. That would be the first time that there's been over 1,000 bills introduced. So, and one of the representatives, Representative Clint Okerlund, is a freshman. He sponsored a resolution, a rules resolution that would limit the number of bills that legislators can introduce. It would have kept it at about 750 under his bill. Representatives could introduce six, and senators could introduce 10 without getting permission from the body. Because he said his point is, if we are the best managed state, and if we're a state that doesn't like red tape and bureaucracy, then why do we need to introduce 1,000 bills every session? He thinks it's too much. But that got defeated. Nobody wants to limit their own ability to introduce bills, and so that's not going anywhere this session. But it is something that leadership has flagged as a concern, and the other thing that Senator Fillmore said, and the stats bear this out, is they're not passing more bills than they have in the past. And so he said, people can introduce as many bills as they want at the end of the session. If they don't get passed, then you just end up having more disappointed legislators.
I was interested, one more thing on this. I was interested in the fact that a couple of Democrats have led the way in terms of bills introduced.
Yeah, that was at that point. Yeah, the Senator Jen Plum and Senator Stephanie Pitcher had introduced the most bills, which was really unusual. Usually, we have pretty reliable. You can reliably predict which senators are going to be at the top. It's usually Wayne Harper and Todd Weiler, and then on the House side, it's usually Ryan Wilcox who is on top in the House. But yeah, I mean, I think over the last few years, particularly Senators Pitcher and Plum have really kind of been very active in the number of pieces of legislation that they're sponsoring.
Let's move to this. As you published this just this morning, Robert, here's the headline: "We'll work it out." Utah Governor Spencer Cox says of a brewing fight with Idaho over a gas tax. These are two ruby red states, neighbors, a brewing fight, Robert.
It's sort of one of those, like when you're neighbor's dog poops on your lawn, you kind of get you have those kind of disputes, I guess. So this has been a big issue this legislative session. House Speaker Mike Schultz wants to change the way that Utah collects its gas tax. Right now, obviously, you go fill up your tank, you're paying about 38 cents a gallon in state gas tax. He wants, but all of the Let me back up a little bit. Utah has five oil refineries that produce about 220,000 barrels of gasoline a day. And so all the gas that's bought in Utah is taxed at the pump, but the gas that's exported out of state doesn't get taxed here. It gets taxed, Idaho drivers pay the Idaho fuel tax, for example. He wants to start collecting tax on those exports, which and then lower the Utah gas tax accordingly. That obviously has Idaho upset because then not only are drivers up there going to be paying the Idaho gas tax, they're going to have to absorb the tax that Utah's assessing on the exports. And so they estimate that it would cost Idaho drivers about $250 million a year, which obviously they're not happy about. The House Speaker up there introduced a resolution calling on the governor and the legislature to abandon this, even went as far in one interview as saying, "Well, we have a lot of water flowing from Idaho into Utah, mostly through the Bear River, and maybe we should hold that back until we can get a resolution to this." And so things got pretty testy, as you can imagine. The speaker said that the Speaker Schultz, the Utah House Speaker, said that threatening to kill the Great Salt Lake doesn't end well for Idaho. And so things are on edge. Obviously, the Speaker Schultz and House Majority Leader Casey Snyder are blaming the petroleum industry for trying to pit Idaho against Utah using some deceptive tactics in their mind, and trying to pit the two states against each other to try to scuttle this deal. Yesterday, we were able to ask Governor Spencer Cox what his view on it is, and he says, he's been in contact with leadership in both states, and he's hopeful that there can be a resolution that both increases the supply of gas, lowers the price, and that both states can live with. So, but this is a huge change, obviously, in the way that Utah's collected its gas tax over the years, and we still haven't seen a bill. Speaker Schultz keeps saying that we'll see one soon, but we haven't seen it yet. So it's very much in flux, and I think an issue that will be consuming a lot of time, chewing up a lot of the oxygen at the Capitol for the last 3 weeks of the session.
Now, Robert, your story, this, if passed, would likely get litigated, right? The Constitution says it's the federal government that regulates interstate commerce, right?
Yeah, that's something that the petroleum industry is pointing to. It's something that the Idaho House Speaker's resolution pointed to, that the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution prohibits states from regulating interstate commerce in that way. And so they think that, if Utah starts taxing exports, it could end up in court, and that could be costly. The Petroleum Association also pointed to that as something, a consideration, a risk, I guess, of going this route. It's been interesting because the Utah Senate leadership has been pretty quiet on it. They said that are waiting to see a bill. This is something that's being driven almost exclusively at this point by House Speaker Schultz, and so it's I guess remains to be seen if excuse me, has the support in the body to actually get through.
No, other states have refineries, right? Could Idaho just switch to, buying from Colorado or somewhere?
Yeah, that's a point the Petroleum Association made, the Utah Petroleum Association made, is that if Utah makes its gas more expensive, then Idaho's going to start looking to places like Montana and Oregon and other states that have refineries. Idaho does not, as I understand, have any refineries, but Utah again has the five. And so, and stepping back a little bit, Speaker Schultz's entire rationale in doing this is that he says Utah has the five refineries, bears the burden of those, in terms of air quality and sort of the ugliness of where those stand. But it doesn't really get the benefit of having less expensive gas. And so he's trying to do this to lower the cost of gas. Actually, if you look at the AAA fuel price averages, Utah is fairly affordable compared to its neighbors, but that aside, Speaker Schultz, in affordability is the buzzword for this legislative session, and so he thinks that by doing this, he can make fuel more affordable, and in doing so, you make things like, shipping groceries and so forth more affordable too. So it's a big fight. It's a big fight between Idaho and Utah, and we'll watch it play out between now and early March.
Let's move to this one. The interesting story, the headline, Utah Arts Education Program sees a spy hop sized cut after a lawmaker criticizes a queer prom event. First of all, Robert, tell us about this arts education program.
Yeah, so the state kind of administers its art grants through this organization called POPS. That's the acronym. I can't remember what it stands for off the top of my head. I'm sorry, but it gives gives a lump sum to this organization that then hands out the grants. And for over 10 years now, SpyHop, which is a video audio sort of production program, has been receiving money through this. Representative Mac McPherson got upset about a queer prom that SpyHop held, not as part of the POPS grant program, but he demanded to see some information both from SpyHop and POPS about how the state funds are being administered, because the state has prohibitions against, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. So he wanted to see how the money was being spent. During this budget hearing this week, he said that, the SpyHop had not provided the information he requested, and he recommended reducing the POPS funding by the amount that SpyHop had been receiving, about $272,000, as I recall. It turns out that the SpyHop had actually provided him the information in an email that had followed up on a meeting that he'd had with the executive director of the organization a week earlier. He says the intern misplaced it, and he hadn't seen it when he made the motion, but he stands by the decision to cut this funding because, or recommend, I guess I should say, cutting this funding because he says POP still hasn't provided the information they wanted. So, Democrats tried to restore the funding. That obviously failed because the Republicans are the majority. And so, as it stands right now, the recommendation is to eliminate this funding to POPs in the amount that SpyHop had received previously. There's still some time left in the budget process, and they're going to try to restore that funding as the budget develops. But Representative McPherson again stands by his motion to cut that funding, or defense of cutting that funding, and we'll see how this plays out.
So, POPs could, if this funding cut stands, POPs could still fund SpyHop, but I guess they would have to reduce the amount to organizations like Utah Symphony, Ballet West, etc.
Yeah. Excuse me, sorry. Yeah, so the legislature didn't specifically prohibit funding from going to SpyHop, but they cut the POPs funding overall by the amount that SpyHop had received. So the POPs can decide if they want to give everybody a haircut. That'd be like the Shakespearean Festival, like you said, Ballet West, Utah Symphony, etc., that do in-school programs, in-school outreach. Or they could just withhold the SpyHop funding, or obviously if the funding's cut, they're going to have to figure something out, but they've got a little bit of latitude there in how they go about doing that.
I guess one point to emphasize, you mentioned it, Robert, that this queer prom is none of that kind of thing is a part of the arts education in schools, we think, right?
Exactly. The prom event was held outside of the school program that SPIHOP does. And so when SPIHOP provided the list of schools it does outreach in, it provided him the handouts that they give to students when they do those outreach programs. But that event was not affiliated with any of their school activities. And so, their point, I guess, is that, this is not related and shouldn't have an impact on their funding levels.
We're talking with politics reporter Robert Gerke. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. One more story, Robert, and then we'll let you go. I learned quite a bit from this article you did with Addie Baird. Substance called kratom. Have never heard of it. I guess it's been out there. There are several pieces of legislation regarding this in this current session. So first of all, tell me what kratom is.
Yeah, it's an extract of a plant that grows in Southeast Asia, and it's a sort of a dietary supplement. We're classified that way, and it's been used for years. It has a pain relief effect and can have some calming effects or stimulating effects depending on the dosages. Usually, I mean, originally it was kind of ground up, turned into a tea. To be drank, but in recent years we've been seeing more and more that companies are concentrating it or synthesizing it and selling it in these little, kind of energy shot bottles that you can use, and it's much more concentrated and much stronger and much more potent, I guess is the word I was looking for, much more potent than the teas. And so there have been problems. Well, people have been dying from consuming it, becoming addicted to it in many instances. And so there are bills pending in the legislature, kind of taking different approaches. A bill that's being sponsored by Senator Mike McKell seeks to ban kratom entirely. And then there are bills by Senator Evan Vickers and Representative Jennifer Daly Provost that would ban the synthesized or concentrated versions that are often sold in gas stations even or smoke shops. It would ban those and allow the leaf that is used in tea to continue to be sold while the state studies the effects of it. So those are all still kind of in motion, the wheels are in motion. But one of the thing that Addie Baird and I wrote this story largely because there was this pretty interesting Senate hearing on these bills, where you had people saying that they, before they started taking kratom, they had this debilitating pain. They started taking it, and then, one woman said she was finally able to get out of bed, and last year she climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. And then you had Lance Crump was an individual I spoke with for this story, whose wife began taking it for similar reasons, debilitating pain, and it alleviated that pain. But then she got addicted and was taking more and more until she eventually died. So you've got these very stark experiences, the stark contrast in experiences with this, and these bills that are handling it in a very different way.
So there is a dispute, right? Some are saying if you use it in not the concentrated form, and especially if you don't mix it with something, that it is safe. Others are saying, well, it's dangerous in any form. We got to ban it.
Right. I talked to Dr. David Kroll from the Colorado University, who's been studying kratom for over a decade now. And he says that, overdosing on the tea is virtually impossible because you just have to consume so much of it to get the psychoactive effects. But Senator McKell counters that, you start with the tea and then you build up a resistance, a tolerance to the effects of it. And so you end up inevitably going to these synthesized and concentrated versions, and that's how people end up in a lot of trouble with a lot of either in with addiction or health effects. And so he doesn't see that as an option to kind of leave the leaf as it is and then just ban the synthesized and concentrate. So this is something that's kind of cropped up. Just really since in 2018, there were 16 deaths in Utah. Before that, there had been fewer than five a year. But since 2018, according to the Office of the Medical Examiner, we've had over 200 deaths in the state from kratom overdose. Now, these kratom overdoses are typically not purely from kratom, but as Dr. Kroll told me, if you take it with any other kind of a depressant, even an antihistamine, or a gabapentin or something like that, the effects can be you can run into a lot of problems medically and potentially even death. I think the medical examiner, if I remember off the top of my head, said 94% of the deaths that they've seen in the state were combined with some other drug, usually a depressant, that led to that.
One more thing, Robert. Senator Kurt Bramble pops up again in this story. I hadn't remembered this. 2019, he sponsored a bill regulating kratom, and then received pretty substantial cash.
So in 2019, he sponsored legislation that would have regulated the sale and marketing of kratom and product, and you know, it sort of became model legislation for a lot of other states around the country. And he didn't, and then he says, shortly after that bill was signed into law, he became a consultant for the Kratom Association and its partner organization. And over the ensuing years was paid over, well, roughly $1.5 million for his work. And so that's kind of how Utah ended up here, you know. And then Senator Bramble, this past session, has been registered as a lobbyist since he left the Senate. He does not list the Kratom Association as one of his clients, so I should make that clear. But it's something that Senator McKell points to about, I think, more to get at how the Kratom Association has operated around the country. You know, there are several states that have moved to ban kratom. Utah's just sort of the latest in this line.
Well, Robert, thanks for telling us about all those stories. You've been busy this week.
Been busy, and it's just going to get busier. We've got about 18 days left of the session, 19 days, and so yeah, things are really going to start ramping up.
We'll hit the halfway point, I think, this week, right?
Yeah, we did on
Yeah.
Wednesday.
Yeah. Yeah. Robert Gerke, a politics reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, has been with us. Thanks, Robert. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Have a great weekend.
You too. You're listening to Beyond the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Coming up following the break, we're going to be talking with water and land use reporter Leah Larson. We'll check in with Utah's snowpack. A hint, one of the quotes from the experts, it's horrible. We've all been seeing this. And we'll talk about this headline. Utah's massive data centers can't get the power they need, so they're building their own. Hope you stay with us through the break.
Startup companies that offer cryonics are pushing the limits of where frosty temperatures can take us. Let's hope they stay on top of things when it's time for the thaw.
Let's imagine that you're going to come back in 200 years. Well, you have to hope that the company hasn't forgotten to pay the electric bill.
We look at the benefits of extreme cold on the next Big Picture Science.
Tune in Sunday morning at 11 here on UPR. Programming support here on Utah Public Radio comes from our members and the Salt Lake Home and Garden Show, presented by Biograss Sod Farms, March 6th through the 8th at Mountain America Expo Center. With experts on landscaping, remodeling, and more, tickets and details at saltlakehomeandgardenshow.com. Support for UPR also comes from Les Olson Company, supporting businesses' IT teams by assisting with technology products like servers, firewalls, phone systems, and network security. Information at lesolsoncompany.com.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams, and we bring in now Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I haven't been as prolific as Gerke this week, so I will do my best to fill up
Right.
the second half of your show.
But you've been pretty prolific, though. Thanks for all the reporting you're doing. Let's start with the snowpack, which is this season hitting records and not in a good way.
Not in a good way. Yeah. Last week we got word from the snow survey, the Utah Snow Survey, that this is the worst winter that we have on record, which I don't think comes as a surprise to a lot of long-timers here. I don't know, Tom, you've been in Utah for a while. Have you ever seen a winter like
This is
this?
pretty bad. This
This
is
is pretty
about the
bad.
worst I've seen. Yes.
Yeah.
Doing a little better, you could say, maybe in some parts in the north, right? But
A little, yeah.
overall
Stress on a
pretty
little bit
bad.
better.
You've got a map here, and level 78% up where I am. One area kind of in the central west, 24%. It's pretty bad this time
Yeah.
of year. Just
Well, and I got
not good.
right, and I've got some bad news for you because that map is about a week old.
Oh,
So I
it
just
is.
looked at the snow survey data from today, and up where you are in the Bear River Basin, it's 60%, 68% of average. So even with that storm we had this last week, things are not getting better. They're actually getting worse.
So Scott Paxman, with the Weber Basin Water Conservancy District, he had that quote. It's horrible, he says.
Yeah, he was pretty blunt. I think water managers are scrambling on how to plan for this just really bad winter that's going to lead into probably a pretty bad summer. Not great for the Great Salt Lake, probably not great for our wildfire season. But I think the bright spot that everyone keeps pointing to, and they're not wrong, is that our soil moisture is high. It's above average statewide. So once the very little snow we have in the mountains does melt and starts to run off, it won't get sucked up into the soil. The parched soils, it will run off more efficiently. We won't quite see, like the really dry conditions we had in 21 and 22 when the Great Salt Lake hit a record low, Lake Powell hit its modern record low. The soil moisture is quite a bit wetter this time of year around. So, yeah, like I said, when the snow does melt, it'll find its way into streams and not just get sucked straight into the ground.
That's a silver lining with it. We have had a fair amount of rain. Does that also, that rain, is that helping the reservoirs at all?
not really. Not yet. I think that they really depend on snowpack to refill. And I think, the Great Salt Lake's a great barometer too for what all this rainfall is doing. And I checked its elevation this morning, and it hasn't even gone up really a drop since about a week ago. So it's still sitting pretty low, about 6 feet lower than where it needs to be to reach a minimum healthy elevation. And of course, every summer, as we move through that hot season, the lake evaporates about 3 feet. So we're probably gonna hit another record low, if not this year, then maybe next year if these kind of conditions persist. So not to be a Debbie Downer here, but things are not great.
Now, Joel Ferry, he's director of the Department of Natural Resources. He said more than 95% of state's water supply is directly tied to snowpack. So that this rain isn't necessarily, we need snow.
We need snow. That's what our whole system is built around, and it's why our water rates have been historically so cheap compared to the rest of the nation. Is we have this great geography where we're a very, very dry state, but most of our population centers are right by the mountains. So those mountains can collect a bunch of snow every winter and then melt in the spring, right when people need to start irrigating their lawns or their farms or whatever. So at right when we need to start kicking those sprinklers on, the snow melts and fills up the reservoirs. And that's the way we've done it for decades and decades and generations. But, as the climate warms and we see our regime shifting more from snowpack to rain, like we're seeing this year for sure, we've got to rethink the whole way we do things. So I think it's got a lot of people sweating under the collar.
Now, for this upcoming summer, it's looking possible. I don't know, probable. Might have to leave our lawn brown, et cetera, et cetera. And you say cities may even have to start enacting drinking water restrictions.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. I mean, like again, I don't think it'll be quite as dire things as things were in 2022, just because we have soil moisture. That's the one bright spot. But yeah, I would like almost it's inevitable we're gonna have some pretty strict watering restrictions. I think Weber Basin said they were gonna delay like the first day that they turn on secondary water to like June 1st, which is pretty late start to the irrigation season. Yeah, I think people are going to have to tighten their belts once again, like we did not even 5 years ago. It's going to be a rough season.
And oh, by the way, this probably is not going to have a great effect on the Great Salt Lake.
Oh no. I mean, I'm kind of expecting any day now for us to get word from the Department of Natural Resources that they filled in that rock-filled causeway that bisects the lake that the railroad runs across. So if you think back to when the Great Salt Lake hit its record low in 2021 and then again in 2022, the state did this grand experiment where they filled in a breach in that causeway so that all that salty water in the north that kind of makes the water pink where the spiral jetty is. Like super salty up there. So they filled in the causeway to prevent some of that salt from migrating south and at least keep some part of the lake viable, like keep the shrimp, the brine shrimp from crashing and the brine flies from crashing, and by extension, all those migrating birds. So that worked out pretty well for them a few years ago. And I'm just waiting, checking my inbox for when they make the announcement that they're going to do that again this year.
By the way, speaking of the lake, you've told me you have a bit of an update on
Oh,
U.S.
yes.
magnesium. We
On
talked
U.S.
about that last week.
magnesium. Yeah, maybe, I guess, depending on who you are, it's a bit of good news. Probably not if you work for U.S. magnesium, unfortunately, but for a lot of the state. So, yeah, we got word earlier this month that the state, because U.S. magnesium filed in bankruptcy court in September, so it's kind of been in limbo. What's going to happen? And to everyone's surprise, I think the state stepped in and intervened and ended up buying up that old polluting plant out there in Tooele County. I think the plan is to donate most of that water that U.S. Magnesium used to the Great Salt Lake, which is great. To put that in context, I think U.S. Magnesium has rights to pull about 145,000 acre feet straight out of the Great Salt Lake and put it in evaporation ponds and just evaporate it away to get the minerals that they need. So that's a pretty substantial amount of water. They definitely don't take that much every single year, but they have rights to. They could, like, until a few years ago, all these mineral companies operating on the lake had rights to just siphon the lake dry, essentially, because they had rights to do so, and the lawmakers stepped in and kind of intervened. But yeah, so with this sale, this bankruptcy sale that the state intervened in, that they get about 145,000 acre feet of water. And to put that in context, like I said, last year, they enabled this program where people could, like, lease their water rights to the Great Salt Lake or donate water to the Great Salt Lake. I think the LDS Church did a big donation that got a lot of headlines a few years ago, and some of the water districts have done the same. So last year, all those donations combined and leases combined amounted to 200 and I think 17,000 acre feet. So this is almost doubling that amount of water. So not insignificant, but still just a few drops in the context of the lake's needs, but it all adds up. Yeah, I can go. I got a little more background information on that U.S. magnesium sale if you want to go into it, like how it came to be and where the money came from, yeah, if you're interested.
Let's no, that, I think that's good. I want to get to make sure we have some time, sufficient time for the data center story. So
Oh yeah.
let's move to that next. You've been covering this, and this is big all over the world, right? Data centers, AI is exploding. Here's the headline: Utah's massive data centers can't get the power they need, so they're building their own. Maybe first an overview. There's quite a few. I hadn't realized there's so many data centers, these big data centers, built, planned, or in progress all over Utah.
And I don't think we're quite getting hammered to the extent that like the DC area is getting, or like some of these communities, like maybe in Arizona and out east, but where some of these communities across the nation are rejecting data centers and fighting back and really don't want them, or like kind of halting plans for them. In Utah, at least our elected leaders and officials are really trying to open the door and encourage them. We want to be a data center capital, I guess, of the Intermountain West, and they're doing everything they can to facilitate that, it seems. But yeah, like based on what I could find, there's about a dozen new ones coming online, and then several existing ones are expanding quite a bit. I think about the Meta slash Facebook data center out in Eagle Mountain. It's expanding quite a bit. So is the Nova data center out on the west side of the Salt Lake Valley. The Salt Lake Valley. So yeah, they're coming. They're expanding. Utah's definitely seeing the trend that the rest of the nation is seeing. but I don't think we're quite seeing like the massive backlash other parts of the country and the world are experiencing.
So a lot of times when I think data center, I think AI. Certainly AI is involved, but you know, if you take Prime or Netflix or you know streaming services, or if you do online banking,
e-commerce, exactly.
All of that's involved in data centers, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, some of these data centers were already here, of course, before the big AI boom. Like Meta's been there for a few years. So is Nova. The eBay data center has been there a while. And of course, there's the NSA data center. I think that was like Utah's first big data center several years ago that everybody was kind of freaking out about how much water it was going to use. So data centers have been around for a while. But you're right. It's really AI that has just driven this surge in demand, not just to build new energy or sorry, new data centers, but build the energy to support them because they just consume, AI gobbles up so much energy compared to like, you know, our old data centers from, I guess, 5 years ago and before.
Give us a sense of the scale. This was boggling my mind as I was reading the story. Huge amounts of energy, electricity, you know, used by these data centers.
Yeah. So, yeah, let's see how to put this in context. So Utah, every business, every home here, everything combined in the state, we consume about 4 gigawatts of energy every year. And that's held pretty steady for many, many, many years. But now with all these data centers coming online, like they, like I said, they're super hungry for energy. They just need all this power to support their AI and these like racks and racks and racks of servers. So there's one data center that broke ground in Millard County. And for just their first phase, they want to build 6 buildings with 69 natural gas generators at each single building, which is just, it's just hard to wrap your head around that many, like nearly 400 generators operating 24/7. And that first phase alone is going to produce 1 gigawatt. So 1/4 of all the energy that every single person in business in the state uses is going to, they're going to need for just this first phase of this data center. And then when it's fully built out, it'll be a total, like the demand they project is 4 gigawatts. And then just like a few, like a less than a mile away, another giant Delta or data center is going in Delta. And they're projecting a need, it's called Creekstone Energy. So they don't even brand themselves as a data center. They're like branding themselves as an energy company called Creekstone Energy. And same thing, they're going to need to build their own natural gas generators because, you know, our utility here, Rocky Mountain Power, just can't supply it. And they're projecting a need for 10 gigawatts. So our energy consumption in the state is going to almost increase by what, like 4 times just because of these 2 data center campuses in Millard County. And that's not taking into account the needs of like the growing Meta data center or the growing Nova data center campus or this new QTS data center campus they're building next to the Meta one in Eagle Mountain. So yeah, our demand, I think lawmakers are feeling the pressure. The demand in energy is just like, to say it's soaring or surging is just an understatement. Like the demands that are being at least projected by these companies are mind-boggling. But of course, you always hear these rumblings that we're in an AI bubble. So we'll see if all these things and these lofty plans come online. But that is what these companies are planning for so far. And like I said, the utility cannot provide what they need. They can't build the generation stations and the transmission lines and everything in time to meet the demand for the energy in time for the data centers when they think they're going to need it. So the data centers are just building their own power plants.
Yeah, I was going to ask, can't Rocky Mountain Power just provide the power? I guess they haven't planned for this, right? They just planned for residential and commercial. So they're going to, is it natural gas most of these are going to?
Yeah, it is mostly natural gas. And, you know, Rocky Mountain Power, to their credit, they do long-term planning. They'll make projections and they'll update them every 2 years. But I just don't think anybody saw, like, AI. Like nobody saw this coming. It took a lot of people by surprise. And I think even Rocky Mountain Power is maybe skeptical that these data center campuses are actually going to fully build out to the extent that they say. So it's hard for them to plan. But yeah, they cannot to provide 4 times the amount of energy that Utah currently needs in like, you know, the course of like a year or two. That's just crazy. Especially as they're retiring a lot of their coal plants, if you think about it, and like switching to other energy sources, it's just, yeah, it's really, you know, like at the same time, big utilities like Rocky Mountain Power, PacifiCorp are grappling with like all these lawsuits over wildfires that were maybe caused by their transmission lines and things. So like they're just scrambling with a lot of issues. But sorry, I forgot your original question there. I really wanted to
Yeah, natural gas. I want to preface that by saying the state, their vision is we're going to power all these or most of these by nuclear power. But it's going to, if we do that, it's going to take a long time for that to come up. So natural gas in the meantime?
Natural gas is what everyone's turning to in the meantime, for the most part. Like these massive data centers, they've just decided like we're going to go all in and build our own generating stations or turning to natural gas. But some that are able to tap into the grid and get what they need from Rocky Mountain Power, they still are worried about brownouts, rolling brownouts and blackouts, because they need to provide data and computing to their customers around the clock. So they're now installing diesel generators as like emergency backup generators, which of course won't be running all the time, 24/7. But you know, like we live in a area infamous for bad air quality. And so I think just bringing a bunch of diesel generators online, even for part of the year, has some people worried that this is going to contribute to pollution in our airshed. And even natural gas, if you think about it, you know, they don't create even nearly as bad of emissions as diesel does, but they still, you know, natural gas is a potent greenhouse gas. It's basically all methane. So it still releases, climate changing emissions and pollutants, and you know, even just extracting natural gas takes a lot of water, takes a lot of energy and resources. So it is still very much a fossil fuel.
Now, some governments, you know, across the nation and here in Utah as well, are welcoming in data centers for economic development. But I don't know. Once the plant is constructed, do they employ that many people? Is it an economic engine?
It's a good question. I know Eagle Mountain certainly believes so, because if you think about how that community came to be, it just kind of exploded in the last decade. It was like there was nothing out there on the west side of Utah County, and now like there's all these huge suburbs popping up, and they don't have a lot of tax revenue. They don't get a lot of, you know, retail or anything out there. So yeah, the data centers that I've been told are like comprise a very, very significant part of their budgets. As far as jobs go, you're right. Like construction out the gate, yeah, they're going to employ a bunch of people just to build these things. They're huge, especially this QTS one going up in Eagle Mountain. And then, of course, this one at Millard, one's going to be on 4,000 acres, which is massive. And then there's this other one, the Creekstone Energy. They're undoubtedly going to employ a lot of people in the construction industry just to get up and running. And then once they are done, once all the construction's over, I think, you know, there are jobs to be had in like security and maintenance, and like they're going to need plumbers and pipe fitters and electricians for just ongoing things. But yeah, you know, they don't, for the square mileage they cover, like, you know, the jobs per acre, if you will, I think the employment rates are low. But I think that's why you see them going up in these communities where they can't get much else. Like Eagle Mountain, like I said, doesn't have a lot of retail. It's no Provo or Orem, you know, there's no like big mall to go to out there. And then down in Millard, they've had like economic hit after hit. Like the meatpacking plant there, the Smithfield pork processing plant, just shuttered in the recent years. And that was a major employer for that area. And of course, the Intermountain Power Plant in Delta, it just took its two coal units offline, not completely offline. The state's mulling whether it wants to take control and like keep those coal units running. But in the meantime, they're just sitting idle. And that was a huge employer for that area as well. So you can see why the prospect of data centers creating all these jobs and things is attractive, and the tax revenue as well.
Ali, one more thing on this. There are worries, and you address this in your story. New Jersey, famously, the gubernatorial race last year, energy prices was all over, and some were blaming these big data centers for jacking up the price for everybody for energy. Do we think that's going to happen in Utah?
Oh man, that is like the million-dollar question on a lot of people's minds, I think. And so far, we've been fortunate in that it hasn't. But you know, a lot of these big data centers haven't come online yet. Lawmakers did pass a bill, SB 132, last year that kind of opened the door for these data centers to build their own power plants, like off the grid, behind the meter. So it wouldn't impact ratepayers so much, and that has been effective in like keeping our utility rates low so far for the rest of us that aren't data centers. But I think it's just going to be like probably like just a game of constant catch up, like as data centers grow and like demand increases and they keep moving into the state, I think lawmakers are going to have to, stay on their toes and stay ahead of that curve if they want to protect ratepayers. But so far, so good. We're lucky that way.
Well, thanks for covering this and all the other stories. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you.
You bet.
And you've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time.